Welcome to the Fear Me Out podcast. Today I have the pleasure of introducing someone who I met, not in person, a long time ago. We've had like a million phone calls and never met in person until this morning. Dr. Bob Nagy is a psychiatrist in town who I respect, and anytime I'm looking for psychiatric help for one of my clients, I send them your direction, which is not always you're not always happy about, because I know you're a really, really busy guy. But today I invited you on the show to talk a bit about yourself and about bipolar disorder.
Dr. Dana Saperstein in the Fear Me Out podcast is pleased to announce that Janus Community Counseling Services is now the proud sponsor of the Fear Me Out podcast. Janus Community Counseling Services is a nonprofit organization in Santa Barbara, California, that is committed to providing professional, affordable counseling. If you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation to the Fear Me Out podcast, please go to www.jccs.org and earmark your donation to the podcast. For more information about making a donation, you can contact Dr. Saperstein directly at 805-452-0006. Thank you.
So, Bob, why don't you tell us a bit about yourself, and then we'll go from there.
Well, first, it's nice to meet you, Dana, face-to-face.
Thank you. You as well.
Yeah, okay, so I'm an L.A. boy, grew up in the San Fernando Valley, and after high school, went to UCLA for undergrad, then went to USC for medical school. And in medical school, you see, your third year medical school is like a buffet line. You go through every specialty to kind of get an idea where you want to go next.
Sure.
And I was interested in orthopedics and pediatrics, but the psychiatrist I knew, he had a great lifestyle. He really enjoyed his life. And in psychiatry in the late 80s, things were really starting to change in terms of medications and things. And the whole serotonin phenomenon was coming on board. And it was like, oh, I want to get on this train.
Yeah.
And so I did a psychiatric residency at LA County.
Wow.
And then my wife was in my medical school class, and she's a hematologist-oncologist.
Uh-huh.
And then I was a ward chief on an inpatient unit after I finished my residency. That was entertaining.
In Los Angeles?
In LA County.
Wow.
In LA County General. And then wife got a job in Santa Barbara, and they also needed a psychiatrist. So I was a player to be named later.
Ah, okay. And she's a
hematology oncologist.
And where does she work?
She works in Santa Barbara.
Okay.
She's cutting back her practice and doing stuff. And
cool.
Then we have two boys who were raised here. And one of them was 5 days old when we moved here.
Wow.
That was pretty entertaining.
Yeah, I can imagine. A 5 year old, or no, 5 day old and moving. Well, I'm so glad you moved here, because I tell everybody all the time that you're the man. So, besides the serotonin phenomenon, what made you interested in psychiatry? Because it's not the easiest profession in the world, that's for sure.
Well, one thing is like, if someone talks about depression or anxiety, every story is different.
That's true.
And a lot of medical conditions, you kind of hear the same thing over and over again, how it presents, what's going on.
Right.
And in mental health, I love listening to stories. And every story is different. It's how it presents, what tools they use to deal with that illness. I've learned so much from my patients that I would not get from lectures or from textbooks or journal articles. And I'm constantly, I just feel privileged to do the work I get to do.
That's very cool. Would you consider yourself as psychopharmacologist, or do you do psychotherapy also, or how do you manage your practice?
I'm a psychopharmacologist who listens to patients.
Oh, okay. Well, that's, no offense to your profession, but that's a really good thing.
Yes.
Because I don't always hear that, you know. I know that you're a super busy guy, but I'm glad that I know so many people over the years who, and currently that I see that see you, and it's been so helpful. So I appreciate what it is you do.
Well, in medicine, you learn very early on that you have to treat the patient. Be careful treating the numbers. And in psychiatry, there's not a whole lot of numbers. I mean, we can have some depression scales and some anxiety scales, but you really got to hear the story and hear what's important to the person you're seeing.
Right.
And that will help guide you where you need to go to help this person.
And what are the age ranges of people that you see?
Well, I'm board certified in general psychiatry, and I did get added qualifications in geriatric psychiatry. But if you practice in Santa Barbara, you're going to be seeing a lot of different age groups.
Sure.
So I do see some young adolescents, but I try not to get too much into that. But I see a lot of between late teens to in their 80s.
Oh, okay.
I'm a general psychiatrist.
Sure. But not children?
Not many.
And what made you decide not to treat like little kids?
In your psychiatric residency, you spend 4 months doing child and adolescent, and it's mostly little people.
Right.
And I kept having the same nightmare. I mean, you don't have to be Freud to figure this out. But in my dream, I was in a rowboat, and I'd pull a child out of the water, dry him off. He'd be sitting there nice and fine. Then he would jump back in the water again.
Oh, okay.
And a lot of the children I saw, we would help get them better. But then they go back, and they get discharged to the same environment.
Right.
That was before. And it was like, oh, I can't have this nightmare the rest of my life.
Right. Well, that's interesting because I don't treat children either for the same reason. I've not described it quite as eloquently as you have. Mm-hmm. Mostly I say I don't treat kids because the parents are usually the problem. So I'd rather treat the problem than the symptom in that regard. So I can appreciate that. Plus, it's really hard for kids to describe what it is they're going through in a way that, an older person can. So what are the types of symptoms and disorders that you treat, Bob?
I'm usually, like most psychiatrists, I'm treating a lot of anxiety disorders, and that's generalized anxiety, that's panic disorder. Obsessive compulsive disorder used to be considered an anxiety disorder, but now it's its own category.
Oh.
So I do see a lot of OCD. And in terms of mood disorders, it's going to be depression. It's going to be different forms of depression. It could be first episode. It could be recurrent. It could be, used to be called dysthymia.
Right.
Now it's called persistent depressive disorder.
Oh, okay.
And then also bipolar disorder. I do have some people with thought disorders, which would be usually schizophrenia.
Right.
Or schizoaffective disorder as well.
But that's not the lion's share of the people you treat.
Yes.
And do you hospitalize people at Cottage in the psychiatric unit?
I'm old enough now to where I can leave my inpatient privileges aside, so I do outpatient work only.
Oh, okay.
But I do know the inpatient team at Cottage, and I work pretty well with them.
Right.
In terms of having someone admitted, following what's going on, and then following up with discharge.
Right. I only asked for that because I worked in the psych ward there I started in 1978 for about 7 years. It was quite interesting back in those days, very different than it is now.
Oh, yes.
It was before managed care, so I saw a lot of people just parked there for months at a time, not really being properly cared for, but that really changed. And what I hear now that it's a much better run organization than it used to be.
Well, and they also have better transitions from once you get discharged.
Right.
Back when I was doing my program back in the 80s, if you were discharged, you were kind of like going home and here's your outpatient therapist to see. Now they have these partial hospitalization programs, intensive outpatient programs, so you can discharge someone a little earlier. They can go back home, but
right.
They have enough support to help them to make that transition back.
Which is extremely important, that's for sure. So getting to bipolar disorder, can you start by describing what it is? Because I don't think that most people really understand what it is. People throw around the term very loosely. I don't think they know what they're talking about most of the time.
Oh, that's one of my biggest problems with that, especially on social media.
Yeah.
If someone gets upset over a wrong order at a restaurant, oh, I must have bipolar disorder because I got upset.
Right. Right. It's pretty amazing.
And most of my patients that have bipolar disorder, they would love to have that as their problem.
Yeah, sure. Wouldn't that be nice if it was that simple and that easy to treat?
So bipolar disorder by definition means you have to have at least one manic episode in your life. If you have like 15 depressive episodes, but one manic episode, you have bipolar diagnosis.
Okay.
And the mania diagnosis, it usually involves at least a week, every minute of every day, for having like insomnia. They talk about pressured speech, where someone feels like a lot of wind behind the person's voice as they talk.
Right.
They have racing thoughts. The thoughts jump around from item to item. They can become very impulsive, usually in ways that gets them into trouble. It could be driving fast. It could be being assaultive. It could be sexual things. And there's a real problem with irritableness. I mean, they can come across as a party. This is a great time and everything. When someone says, no, you can't do that, then you can get some more of the hostile irritableness, angry manic symptoms.
Okay.
And then this cluster of symptoms has to cause problems. It has to either social, occupational, or academic problems. Like you get arrested, you get fired from your job, you get thrown out of your house of worship, your family kicks you out. And so that's part of the criteria for it.
Okay.
And what happens usually is people will have a manic episode, and then they go into a depressive episode. It's like an S curve.
Oh, okay.
The mood goes up and goes down.
Right.
And I have had patients who're manic, and they're looking scared. While they have a euphoric glow about them, there's a worried look in their face. And you ask them what's going on, and they go, "I know it's coming after this is over.
Oh,
it's
okay.
Going to be bad."
Right.
And I think some of that depression is the natural course of the illness. But part of it also can be when they look back and they realize all the destruction they did to themselves.
And that only can occur to them after they're out of the manic episode.
Yes, but some of them, they're grizzled veterans, so they know that even when they're high from the mania,
oh.
They know what's coming.
Oh, okay.
And it's so sad to see that.
And like how extreme can a person's behavior be when they're in a manic phase?
When you work at LA County General, you see the more difficult patients come in.
Right.
This guy comes in with three Secret Service agents. This guy's in a suit and tie. And he thought he was President of the United States. He went to the government building at Wilshire and Sepulveda, the Fed building there.
Right.
He walked and said, "I'm the President of the United States. You're all fired."
Really?
Okay. So when someone says they're President of the United States in a federal building, Secret Service gets a call.
Oh,
so
yeah.
The Secret Service brought him to the county ER, and he goes, I'm talking to him. He goes, "I am the president. Look, I have Secret Service with me." And it's like, oh, this poor man, when his mania gets treated, he's going to be on everyone's database. If this guy tries to get on a plane, if he tries to go anywhere, he's going to be marked as someone you have to keep an eye on. And this guy was so happy to be in the ER because he was going to be moved somewhere to the Western United States. I mean, the Western White House, which he had, was somewhere.
Uh-huh.
It was so sad because this guy's life is going to get very complicated when he gets better.
Sure. And so it can, I mean, the person can actually seem psychotic, I guess, in a way.
Yeah, I would say he was psychotic. Oh,
right.
Okay. With mania, you can become psychotic with mania. It can be, with psychosis, we're talking about hallucinations, auditory hallucinations. But a lot of times it's grandiose delusions,
right?
And persecutory delusions. People are out to get them because they're such a strong, special person. People are jealous of them, and therefore will try and get them.
Huh. That in some ways sounds like narcissistic personality disorder in a way.
To an extreme.
Or at least most of our politicians. Yes. Like, they would qualify easily. Is there an age, like with schizophrenia, oftentimes it starts at late adolescence, right? Is that
correct?
Yeah. What about bipolar? What's the earliest that you would notice somebody having a manic episode?
You're looking usually like in their mid-20s.
Oh, really?
It's a little later than schizophrenia.
So,
I mean, you can't present earlier, but usually you're looking in the mid-20s is when they have the first manic episode.
So, I mean, I was listening to a woman who was describing having her first feelings of, you know, grandiosity when she was in junior high school. And I thought, boy, that's awfully early. Now, she never told anybody what was happening because it scared her so much. And it didn't get so extreme that, that she became psychotic.
Yeah, you see, so you could say she was having presentation at that time, but it wasn't to the point to where the social occupational stuff was going on wrong.
Oh, okay.
So I think your point's well taken that people will note, my first manic episode, I was 24. But I had some of this stuff way before then.
Oh,
so okay. I think it is there, but they don't need help at that point yet. It doesn't get severe enough to where the presentation is pretty obvious.
And is there a spectrum of severity with bipolar illness?
Yeah, there is, and like the most common one is bipolar 1.
Okay.
There's now I don't know how many numbers there are now, but I'll explain why they're out there. But there's a concept of in medicine and science called lumpers and splitters. A splitter is like you have a sleep problem, you have an energy problem, you have a concentration problem, and a weight problem. That's a splitter. I'm gonna go, no, you have depression. That's what you have. So I will try and lump things together.
Okay.
And if you look at bipolar disorder, there's a spectrum, and I'll lay that out here. There's bipolar type 1, which is you've had a full-blown manic episode. Bipolar type 2 is someone who's had a hypomanic episode. It sounds kind of weird being hypomanic, but it means you're almost manic, but you don't get in trouble for it.
Oh, okay.
And so you have a lot of energy. You may not need to sleep as much. You're really on your game. But it's kind of contained.
Okay.
That's bipolar type 2. And then you have ones where like an antidepressant will trigger a manic episode.
And can you talk a little bit about why you think that happens and what that's all about?
Which one?
The one about being triggered by an antidepressant.
Yeah. Okay. So when you give someone an antidepressant, sometimes you uncover a bipolar patient.
Right.
I'm not convinced it's a separate category. I really, in my mind, it's still bipolar disorder. You're going to treat them the same way you would someone who doesn't have an antidepressant-induced mania. The way you kind of see this is you give someone an antidepressant, and let's say every symptom they give you is depression. They have nothing that they can relate by their history to mania.
Right.
And typically an antidepressant works in 2 to 8 weeks.
Okay.
If you put someone like this on an antidepressant, they're so much better in 2 days.
2 days?
And 2-3 days. And they're going, oh my gosh, this medicine is really working for me. My mind's really productive. I'm not sleeping all the time. And my family says I'm talking faster than usual. It's like, oh my gosh, we're going to, it's like a Saturn V rocket.
Right.
If you don't stop it right now, that thing's going to go into outer space.
Oh, okay.
And so what you do is you stop the antidepressant immediately. You make sure they get their sleep. And then you have to relook at what you're going to do to help this patient out. But sometimes that gets missed. And all kinds of bad things can happen to that person because they think they're depressed, but they're manic. And they haven't checked in with their doctor or their doctor missed it.
Wow.
I had a patient who, this is back in the mid-90s, and she was depressed and wasn't sleeping that well. But her symptoms, her whole constellation of symptoms was depression. So I put her on trazodone, which is a sedating antidepressant.
Right.
Put her on 100 milligrams at bedtime. She called me a couple days later and go, I'm not sleeping very good, maybe even less. That was a tip off I should have caught. Okay. I said, well, go to 150 and let me see you in a couple of days.
Okay.
She came in 2 days later. She had, there's a thing called the glitter sign for bipolar disorder, where they will accentuate their makeup. This lady had the reddest lipstick I've ever seen.
Oh, okay.
Her eyes were all made up. She had a low-cut dress on and had a big smile. And I'm thinking, oh, my gosh, the train is leaving the station here.
Right.
And we have to stop this immediately and use a different kind of something else to help her sleep.
Uh-huh.
But her whole diagnosis changed because of what that trazodone did. A sedating antidepressant should not make someone have less sleep.
Right. Yeah, well, especially that. Yeah. I mean, I've known people that have taken that drug and it does work when the way it's supposed to. And it helps them sleep. So I can imagine that if it doesn't, then you've got a big problem.
Yes.
So a person like that the drug triggered the manic episode, do they then continue to have manic episodes moving forward when they're not on an antidepressant anymore?
That's a good question. And some people no, some people yes.
Okay. Because I've known a couple of people that have had that experience, either not necessarily from an antidepressant, but from recreational drugs. And then, once they get off the drug, they've never had another manic episode in the course of 10 or 15 years, since that time. How do you sort of explain that? Do you know?
Well, I'll tell you what I do then is like, I try and get this episode quieted down. I educate the patient at length. You cannot go on any antidepressant. If somebody has an antidepressant effect, you can't go on it. And the person's feeling fine. I said, okay, you come back and just check in with me. We'll see how things are going.
Right.
Then I educate them what MANI is. I go, I may not be your doctor in 5 years.
Right.
But if you have something like this happen without taking an antidepressant, you need to be on a mood stabilizer.
Oh, okay.
So I won't start that mood stabilizer after the first episode driven by the antidepressant. But if it comes back again, no matter what's going on, I'll put you on a mood stabilizer.
And can you describe what a mood stabilizer is? I mean, I know, but I don't think most people know what that means.
Okay, so it's like this is my Icarus model. I use Icarus to describe my patients about bipolar disorder. Remember, he's the guy that was on the island with his dad. They were banished to an island. This is from a Greek mythology. But I really think they were talking about bipolar disorder.
Right.
And the father said, listen, we can get off this island. We're going to use some of these bird feathers and some wax, and we're going to fly off this island. He goes, but we have to be careful. If we go too low, the feathers will get wet and we'll crash.
Right.
If we go too high, the wax is going to melt, and then we're going to crash. And Icarus, of course, takes off. He gets above the clouds. And if you read any description of this, it sounds like he's having a manic episode.
Right.
He feels all powerful, wonderful. It's all great. And his father says, you know, get your butt down here. Get down here. He doesn't listen to that.
Right.
And then, of course, like his father warned him, he ends up crashing into the ocean because the wax melted.
Right.
And I really can't help but think that was the ancient Greeks looking at someone who had bipolar disorder.
Right.
So what I do is I go, a mood stabilizer is like the dad. He's trying to keep you in the middle, in the sweet spot. Not go too high, not go too low. But it doesn't mean you don't have a mood. It just means you don't go way above or way too low.
So it just sort of shrinks the intensity.
The range, yeah.
Right, okay. And can you describe the names of some of those?
Okay, well, the first one was lithium. And lithium was approved, FDA approved, like in the late 70s, early 80s. And it was a game changer because if you had bipolar disorder in the United States, they treated you with antipsychotic medications. And that's like Haldol, Thorazine.
Right.
And those medicines don't really work really well for mood stabilizers.
No.
But they keep you from doing terminal impulsive things.
Right.
But then you're at risk for tardive dyskinesia. You have all the weight gain with it. And your focus and concentration is not going to be very good on those meds.
Right.
Okay. So then lithium came on the market. And lithium made a huge difference for people that could tolerate it and do well with it. But a couple of things about, I mean, I'm a big fan of lithium.
Okay.
But I'm aware of some of the problems with it. Some of the problems are that it can affect your thyroid. Okay, so usually if you're on lithium, you should have your thyroid levels, your thyroid function checked maybe 3 times a year. Okay, but if your thyroid is slowed down by the lithium, you can take thyroid hormone, which is common for a lot of people,
right.
And that's fine. Okay. That's not really a big negative.
Okay.
The more disconcerting problem is kidney function. If you take lithium for a long number of years at a pretty high dose, you can have kidney failure.
Oh, dear.
And I've had a few patients who referred to me who were in kidney failure because their lithium levels were checked, but they weren't checking their kidney function.
Oh.
And it's not like you're doing fine one day, the next day you're in kidney failure. There's a trend of certain lab values that you can see and go, this trend's not good.
Okay, yeah.
We have to change gears now. And then when someone's in kidney failure and they're on dialysis, they can go back on lithium. Because the kidney is taken care of. It doesn't work anymore.
Right.
But it's really devastating for patients because kidney failure means you're going to dialysis 3 times a week.
Right.
And your life expectancy just got a lot shorter.
Well, that's really scary. I mean, how do you get people to cooperate with taking lithium when they know the side effects could be that devastating?
Okay, so I've been writing lithium prescriptions since the late 80s. I've had 3 patients who've had this, and all 3 of them were followed by somebody else, and they hadn't been tracking their kidney function.
Oh, okay.
So, and the thing is, okay, it used to be lithium was the only game in town.
Right.
Lithium was the only mood stabilizer. Okay, now there's a bunch of other ones that actually have FDA approval.
Oh, okay.
There's Lamictal, Lamotrigine. There's Depakote, and there's Tegretol.
Oh, okay.
And okay, so it's interesting that those are three are all anticonvulsants. So you have lithium, which is a salt. It's on the periodic table.
Right.
You've taken 10th grade chemistry. You know about lithium.
Yeah.
And the other ones are anticonvulsants. And the idea is, interesting idea, it's that, like, if someone has a seizure, you're at a higher risk in the next day or so of having another seizure. Having a seizure increases the risk of having another one.
Uh-huh.
With bipolar disorder, you have a mood disturbance. You've increased the odds of having another mood disturbance coming down the road. And the more mood disturbances you have, the harder they are to treat. So the idea is that these anti-seizure drugs are really anti-mood disturbance changes for the same reason. It's almost like a parallel process for how that works.
Who figured that out? That's pretty brilliant, actually.
A lot of smart people on the East Coast.
Oh. And do those sort of convulsant drugs carry side effects that are as devastating as lithium?
Well, it's a different category of side effects.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so like one is like, if you're in your 20s and you want to have children, being on anticonvulsants can be potentially very devastating to your baby.
Oh.
So we have problems there. Tegretol, which can affect your bone marrow. So you have to have your blood level, your CBC, your complete blood cell count, checked on a regular basis.
Oh, okay.
And all three of these drugs have levels that need to be monitored. Okay. Depakote can affect Depakote can affect your liver and your pancreas.
Okay.
Those need to be checked.
Right.
And Lamictal is a pretty clean drug, but if you get a rash with it, like on your mucosal membranes, like the inside of your nose or in your mouth,
okay,
you can die from that.
Oh dear.
I've never seen it.
Lamictal's
been around for 20 years.
Right.
I hope I never see it, but I'm always looking for my first skin reaction, but I haven't seen it. So all these drugs have got certain risks and benefits with it. And I think anticonvulsants are more likely to cause concentration problems, fatigue problems.
Right.
I've had patients say, this drug is really helping me out, but I'm a manager of a company. I can't run meetings anymore.
Right.
Can we do something about that?
So what criteria do you use to decide which drug that you're going to give your patient?
Okay, there's a bunch of things to come into play. Okay, one is some people have bipolar disorder, suicide is a risk. People think that suicide is only have to worry about with depression, but bipolar patients also have that. And then it's like lithium, there's a lot of controversy about this, but I'm in the lithium advocacy group that feels that lithium has a potent anti-suicide effect to it. And as such, I'm more likely going to use that with someone who really fights that dark piece of bipolar disorder. So that's one thing. I will look at what's the family history. Because there might be a family history of other people with bipolar disorder. If everyone in the family's been on Lamictal and they didn't do well, I'm not going there.
Right.
If anybody has any kidney function problems or some questionable things there, I'm not going with lithium.
Oh, okay. So doing a proper history is super important.
You have to get a good medical history.
Right.
Well, let me go back. I'm rambling, but let me go back again. The anticonvulsant drugs, okay, here's one risk factor you have with these agents is like, if you're on them for a period of time at a healthy dose, you cannot stop them quickly.
Oh.
Okay. If you're on an anti-seizure drug and you stop at cold turkey or you didn't get your refill done or whatever, you could have a seizure.
Really? Even if
you don't
never
have a seizure
had one
disorder.
Wow.
Like if you're on lithium and you skip a couple of days of lithium, nothing bad's going to happen.
Right.
The anticonvulsant ones, I haven't had a patient where that's happened. But I scare patients. I go, you let me know. I don't care where you are. I'll call it in for you.
Right.
And make sure that gets taken care of. But that's a risk factor for any of the anti-seizure drugs.
Right. I remember once, more than once, when I worked in this psych ward, that somebody would come in with an overdose of lithium. And, whoa, that was really scary to see where they went. Because, I mean, I've never seen somebody become so psychotic for so long. Why does lithium do that to people? Do you know?
Well, I think it affects the electrolytes in your body.
Oh, okay.
And your kidneys get affected and other things get affected. So I think that psychosis is not like a thought disorder, but that's more like an intoxication and side effect of the lithium.
Oh, okay. So I'm assuming that you make sure that people are constantly monitoring the blood levels of lithium and that sort of thing.
Yeah, and the other thing with like lithium is like, okay, I was an attending at LA County, and this new drug called ibuprofen came on the market. Okay, yeah. And it was a prescription drug in the early 90s.
Really?
And we had a patient who had bipolar disorder, had a lithium level you want to be between 0.6 and 1.2.
Okay.
And this guy's level was like 1. Okay. He had really bad arthritis, so he put him on 400 milligrams three times a day of ibuprofen.
Right.
And like 2 days later, this guy is like with a wide base gait. His feet are really wide, like he's on a ship that's rocking in the ocean.
Huh.
And he's peeing down his leg. And he's drinking water all the time. And it's like, this guy looks like he's lithium toxic.
Right.
His lithium level is like over 2.
From the ibuprofen?
Yes, because some medications, what they do is so lithium is a salt, you pee it out.
Right.
Okay, but there are some medications that make your kidney difficult to get rid of lithium. Oh. And ibuprofen was one of them.
Interesting.
And when this showed up, it's like, oh my gosh, it has to be the ibuprofen. That's the only thing that we've changed with this guy. And it wasn't reported by the FDA. Nothing had been reported about that. So then that's one. Certain blood pressure medicines also can make lithium levels go elevated. Okay, and so if you look in like the PDR or something, it'll say, don't combine these.
Right.
But that's not really true. It just means you got to know what you're doing. Right. So if I have someone on lithium and they have a headache, I go ahead and take a couple ibuprofen. If you need to be on ibuprofen for 4 days or longer, I'm going to cut your lithium dose in half.
Oh, okay.
It works out fine. If they're really stable with a bipolar disorder and they get added a blood pressure medicine that can cause a drug interaction, I know, talking to a cardiologist about what blood pressure medicine to pick, they're not going to listen to me. So I'll have to work around them.
Right.
And like if you're on one of those blood pressure medicines that increases lithium, I'll decrease the dose and check a level in a couple of days.
Oh, okay.
Because if someone's doing well in a mood stabilizer, I'm very loath to change it because of something else. I will make the lithium levels work.
Right.
And explain to my patients what I'm doing. And they kind of smile like, hey, this is kind of cool. I get to fine tune this stuff.
My psychiatrist is a scientist.
I try to be an educator. It saves me a lot of calls.
Right. So just to get some more information about bipolar disorder, is it equal amongst men and women?
I think it's more men than women.
Really? And is there any sort of scientific literature that would kind of describe why that is? Or is that a mystery?
I'll put that as a mystery.
Yeah. Do we have any idea what causes bipolar disorder?
I think this is one of these multiple etiologies. I think there's a family history.
Okay.
That can do. So part of it's in your DNA.
Right.
But what's interesting is that if someone has bipolar disorder and another family member has a psychiatric diagnosis, the most common psychiatric diagnosis is not bipolar disorder, it's major depression.
Oh, interesting.
Okay, so what happens is like, let's say I see someone who has a history of depression and they talk about their cousin or their aunt has a history of bipolar disorder. I'm not treating my patients as if they have bipolar disorder. Some mental health people go, you have a relative with it, I'm treating you as if you have bipolar, even though you've never had a manic episode.
Well, that doesn't sound 100% responsible, is it?
That's not a good idea. Yeah. I don't think it's a good idea. What I tell my patients is that, okay, there's a good chance statistically that the way you're talking, your history and your family history, you have depression. Okay, but let's say this is bipolar disorder. And I have them describe to me when they've seen their family member ill, not doing well. And I go, okay, do you know what those symptoms are like? And they go, yeah. If you start to have some of that stuff the next couple of days, you have to call me as soon as possible.
Right.
Because it could be that we're uncovering something.
Oh, okay.
And because they've actually seen it, they know what they're looking for.
Okay.
And so I say, you might have an elevated risk of having that. But if I was going to bet on this, this is depression. This is not bipolar disorder.
Okay.
But I want to cover all the odds.
Oh, well, and that makes a great deal of you know, that's common sense, basically, right? So besides maybe the genetic component.
Oh, okay. I think sometimes there's some stress responses. Like Freud talked about the manic defense. And his idea was that bipolar disorder, mania is the outside of depression. I'll combine what I talked about before with this, and that when you're being overwhelmed and just you're being beaten back, Well, you push against that by saying, I'm powerful. I can do anything. I have a lot of special things that I can do,
okay,
and qualities and things. And once the mania gets beaten down because of reality or whatever happens, you see the depression. And so what I talked about, the S wave before, Freud will say, well, that's the manic defense that they gave away. It was covering depression. It's actually a form of depression.
Oh, that's interesting.
And so you can look at mania sometimes as people under incredible stress will present with mania. But it's like, okay, why do some people have that and other people don't? Not quite sure why.
Okay.
But that goes into treating people. It's like, if that's one factor, the stress level, you tell people, okay, we have to work on a stress plan for you.
Sure.
Because that's something that you don't want to get.
Okay. So you have genetics, you have stress. Anything else?
You look at substance abuse as a possible trigger. Okay.
Right.
And
right.
It can be very confusing as to what is substance abuse and what is bipolar disorder. Did one trigger the other one? And you have to differentiate them out. And because it's so hard sometimes, that makes me think that substance abuse history will contribute to people with bipolar disorder, although it's not like bipolar disorder secondary to drugs. I really look at those as different things going on.
And what kind of drugs, generally speaking, could lead a person to have a manic episode?
Okay, it's going to be things like stimulants,
right?
Cocaine, methamphetamine, all that category of stuff is the thing I'd be most worried about.
Yeah. You know, I have worked with a few people that have been diagnosed as, having bipolar disorder. And for some odd reason, when they're in a manic episode, they're attracted to stimulants. Is that a common thing that you see, or is that just something that I kind of know?
No, I think that's common.
So it doesn't make, I mean, if you're already high and really flying, what's the draw to, for more rocket fuel?
I think they feel so good. And maybe, like, if a little's good, maybe a lot's better.
Oh, okay.
I really think that's part of that.
Right.
It's like if your car goes 85 miles an hour, you're going, I wonder if I can get it to 100.
I think that takes a certain type of person. You know?
But the way people look at things, that risk-benefit ratio, it's distorted when you're in that state.
Right. And does drugs like methamphetamine cause people to become bipolar sort of in a more permanent sense?
You wonder about that. If someone has a very short history with stimulant abuse or cocaine and things like that, you don't usually see it. But people that have a longer use of it,
yeah,
you can see people that look, they have like a thought disorder,
right,
or bipolar disorder.
Uh-huh.
And the idea is like, if someone is not using substance abuse, then whatever you see is probably the underlying disorder, like bipolar disorder.
Right.
But you really wonder if this chronic drug use doesn't just tweak your brain enough to where, well, that's where you are now.
Well, that's what I was wondering, because I could be incorrect in this, but I read about the changes that have happened with meth over the course of time, that it used to be plant-based and now it's solvent-based because it's cheaper to make it out of solvents than it is out of whatever the plants they used in the past. And it seems as though it causes people to become psychotic or manic much, much more quickly than it did in the past. And I was just, I mean, I know you don't necessarily treat that population, but I'm wondering if that's something that you've seen.
Well, I've seen that with cannabis. Okay.
Really?
When I was in junior high school and high school, I knew a lot of my colleagues, my buddies in school and stuff, they smoked pot and they would say it just made them cool and relaxed and stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
And then after a period of time, a lot of them would suddenly have anxiety attacks.
Right.
And now I'm seeing that more common. Now I see a lot more people having problems with cannabis where they have anxiety disorders or
right.
even just get psychotic.
Yes.
And like they can stay psychotic for quite a while.
Uh-huh.
And I can't help but think it's not that the strength of that stuff, the potency of what they're taking is way higher than what guys did at Lawrence Junior High when I was there.
Oh, I mean, I can vouch for that, because when I was in high school, smoking pot every day was commonplace.
Yes.
And now it's like, whoa, it's a completely different drug altogether, or so it seems.
So I think it goes in other categories of drugs as well. Things uh-huh. have just ratcheted up.
So sometimes you might see somebody that comes in that's had a manic episode, or more common with anxiety disorders from the strong marijuana that's available?
Yeah.
Wow.
But with the marijuana, I've seen it's usually It's usually white guys between 18 and 24 who smoke a lot of pot, yeah. like a lot of it. Like that's all they do.
Yeah.
And you interview them and you can't tell they're not schizophrenic. If you didn't know about the marijuana history, you would think they have schizophrenia.
Really? It's that intense?
Yeah. I have a patient who was so psychotic. He was a freshman at UC Santa Cruz and was in his dorm room. And the description was his roommates that, you know, this guy's not well. The RA got involved, went to the hospital, and he had a drop out at UC Santa Cruz. And because I was following this guy, I had seen him before. He did a little bit of pot, but now he was doing like all the time. And right. And what happened was he stopped using marijuana, but he had to be on an antipsychotic for 2 years.
Wow.
And I was able, every time I kept trying to cut him off his risperidol, he gets psychotic again. And I'm thinking, wow, oh my God, I hope this isn't permanent.
Huh.
But 2 years, he was able to get off it. He got a college education, and he now makes a lot of money and doesn't need to see me anymore.
And he, I'm assuming, doesn't use marijuana anymore either. So that's really amazing that you such extreme reactions.
Okay, thank God it's not common.
Oh, okay.
But it is out there.
That's very interesting. So what else can you tell me about bipolar disorder? You've given me tons of information. I'm just kind of curious.
Okay, well, a couple things. Just to overview is that, like, this is a chronic condition.
Okay.
It's something that you're going to have the rest of your life, and some people are devastated by that. And I go,
sure.
Listen, you know what? You see most doctors. Most doctors don't cure anybody of anything. Most doctors teach you how to manage something.
Right.
If you have a thyroid problem, you have a blood pressure problem, you can do some things around the side, but you're probably going to be medicated for that indefinitely.
Okay? Right.
And most illnesses that people have, asthma, diabetes, hypertension, it's all a matter of, okay, we all have it. You got to cope with it. And so for bipolar disorder, it's like, okay, let's get real smart about the illness. Let's see what you know about yourself and what do you know about the condition and be good at picking up signs early on, because I've had a lot of patients who are on their way to having a manic episode. They call me, okay, let's do this, and we can nip it in the bud.
So what are the do this and do that? What sorts of things can you advise someone who may be that sophisticated in their illness that they can recognize that they're ramping up?
Well, okay, so this is bidirectional. People who don't sleep well can do some, let's say you have bipolar disorder.
Right.
And you don't sleep well because you got some work going on or something a couple nights in a row, that could lead to a manic episode.
Oh.
People with manic episodes, one of the first signs is they don't need to sleep anymore.
Right.
So it's like bipolar patients will say, I need to sleep.
Right.
And like the LA Times had an article about Klonopin, about how dangerous it is and all this kind of stuff. And that's a whole different category. But someone wrote a letter about that article saying, I take 3 milligrams of Klonopin every night. Thank God I have it because I have bipolar disorder. If I don't sleep, my life will end. Thank God I have my Klonopin.
Okay.
So, okay, I don't write Klonopin for every patient, but it's like, if I can use a drug like Klonopin or Temazepam for a week just to get the sleep under control, and we make sure they're taking their mood stabilizers, and hey, what's going on in your life? What's triggering things? And we'll try and dial that back so I'd rather prevent an episode than treat an episode.
And what class does Klonopin fall into in terms of?
It's a benzodiazepine.
Oh, okay.
So that's what there's a big push, don't prescribe these at all.
Right.
But if you write for a week or 2 weeks to put a damp on this, that works really well.
Sure.
They're not on it for very long. We've made some other changes of what's going on in their life to kind of push back on this mood exacerbation.
Anything else besides that particular medication?
Well, the thing is, it could be like, again, a lot of times there's things going on in their life they're not aware of. They're not like, it's like, well, you just told me, you know, your boss says you're going to be laid off.
Oh,
or
okay.
Your kid just got arrested.
Right.
And they don't pick up on that. That might be a trigger for what's going on.
I see. So you want people to be really aware of their lifestyle, certainly the amount of stress that they're under. Is there any dietary or other, like, you know, with depression, exercise is really important. Good sleep is important. Proper diet is important. What about with bipolar? Is it same sort of thing?
Same sort of thing.
Yeah.
And what there's a couple of books I have my patients who are brand new to read. One is by Kay Jamison called The Unquiet Mind.
The Unquiet Mind?
Yes.
And what's the author's name again?
Kay Jamison.
Okay.
So here's her story. She and a guy named Frederick Goodwin, They wrote the textbook on bipolar disorder. It's a two-volume set, came out in the early 90s. It's like maybe 1,000 pages.
Wow.
And she was a psychologist at Johns Hopkins. Okay. A few years later, she wrote a book about herself, Unquiet Mind, about how she has bipolar disorder.
Uh-huh.
And the book starts with her walking through the UCLA MPI parking lot in a manic episode.
Wow.
It's like, oh my gosh, I got to read this. She's a great storyteller, and it comes about her struggles to take lithium and how she has done well with this stuff. And she's an incredible speaker. And so she's not only does she have the illness, but she's like a world expert in bipolar disorder.
I mean, that's amazing.
She co-wrote one of the Bibles of bipolar disorder.
Okay.
And again, you can Google her, see her on YouTube.
Okay.
And that's one of her big areas of interest is bipolar disorder. And also, she wrote a book called, it's Touched by Fire is the name of the book.
Okay.
She did a review of artists, musicians, and singers and composers who have bipolar disorder. And she reviews their work about where their mood state was at the time they did this.
Right.
It's a great read.
And is that the second book that you recommend sometimes?
Okay. Well, no. Okay. That's another one. People who go, okay, I read Kay Jameson's first book.
Okay.
Here's a second one.
Okay.
And then the other book is Patty Duke wrote a book.
Oh.
Called a Brilliant Madness. And Patty Duke, I'm sure you're old enough. You're
older than me,
but you get it.
Oh, okay, absolutely.
So here's a woman who wins an Academy Award. Do you remember the TV show she had in the 60s?
I can still sing the song.
Okay. So she played herself and her French cousin.
Uh-huh. I remember that.
It was, looking back, it was ridiculous. It was the number one show.
Yeah.
And then Patty Duke kind of disappeared. How is someone who had that number one show and have Academy Award, what would make her disappear?
Uh-huh.
Because she became a bitch to deal with.
Oh, okay.
And had a lot of troubles. And then she went to see this analyst in Beverly Hills to help her. He talked to her for 1 hour and goes, you need to be on lithium.
Oh, okay.
And no one had talked out that she'd had bipolar disorder.
Uh-huh.
A lot of people go many years without the diagnosis being made.
That's so remarkable because it's such a debilitating disease.
Yeah.
And what about the prejudice in our world about people that have, mental illness, especially being bipolar? Do you see that?
Yes, because... Well, that person's bipolar. It's used as a pejorative.
Okay.
And people that have bipolar disorder, they are busting their butts to get by and make it work.
Okay.
And they try really hard. I'm very impressed by the courage of a lot of my bipolar patients have because it's really hard.
Yeah.
And then to have it used as like a slang word, that really irritates me. That person's bipolar.
Oh, right. Yes, I hear that all the time.
He's a jerk. He's bipolar.
Yeah. I tell people all the time, I don't think you realize what you're saying, right? It is, it's like a racist statement to make in a certain way.
I agree.
Because we have such prejudice against people that's, in quotes, suffer from mental illness. And like somehow it's their fault, right? Or they did something to cause it in some way, or they can stop it just by using willpower. And I think the last time that willpower worked with somebody who's in a manic episode was never. Or very infrequently, anyway.
I can't recall any of
them. I can't either. So when a person has a manic episode and then they go into a depression, is there a time frame before they may have another manic episode, or is that variable?
It varies. And like there's there's a condition called rapid cycling bipolar disorder.
Oh, okay.
And that's someone who's had four or more distinct episodes in 1 year.
Wow.
And if you're in that condition, how are you going to hold a job?
If
you're having four episodes, you have to be hospitalized four times, you're not going to be able to have a job in most places.
Right.
Now there's a thing called mixed. Bipolar mixed means you have manic and depressive symptoms at the same time.
Wait a second, please. You got to explain that. I don't
know. Okay. Like I've seen this in the hospital where someone, I see in the morning when I did hospital rounds, they'd be very depressed, couldn't get out of bed in the morning. And by the by dinner time, they're leading a revolt over how bad the food from the cafeteria is.
All in one day?
In one day. So that's called a mixed. That's mixed. Rapid cycling means four or more discrete episodes in a year.
So rapid cycling is not somebody that would be manic or depressed in the morning and manic in the afternoon.
But both those conditions are much harder to treat.
I was going to say, they sound really
difficult.
There's
a lot going on there, and you usually have to be on multiple mood stabilizers and things like that. But the thing is, it's like also when someone's been hospitalized for bipolar disorder, also with depression, they may be discharged in a couple of weeks.
Right.
But if you talk to them over the period of a year, though, they may not feel better. Like, they are, I'm not back to myself for 9 to 12 months.
Right.
And so it's like the people are discharged, and they go, well, I'm discharged. I should be able to do what I was doing 2 months ago. You know, this is a long recovery process.
Right.
And give yourself a little credit. Don't beat on yourself because it's taking this long to get better.
Boy, it's such a sad malady. What's the percentage of people that commit suicide that are bipolar?
It's not as high as depression. I would probably say 2 or 3, 4%, 5% maybe, okay. Which is, that's a lot of people.
That is a lot of people. But I guess if you're talking about somebody who is never going to be cured and they have a really severe form, I mean, I know I'm being morbid, but it kind of makes sense in a certain way that if you don't have the strength, like you say, the people that you see they're using a lot of strength and resourcefulness in order to move forward in their lives. If you don't have that, it sounds like it's going to take you down for sure.
Yeah, people who are suicidal, usually there's two things that are going on. One is they're in horrible pain, physical pain, psychic pain, spiritual pain.
Right.
And two is there's no hope it's going to get better.
Yes.
So therefore, they can make it get better. They're going to end their life.
Right.
So when I see someone who's suicidal, my job is not to go, this isn't that bad. What are you talking about?
Yeah.
No, I could never do that. But what I can say is, what's been done to help you? I go, here's four things that haven't been done.
Right.
I think there's a good shot that one of these is going to work.
Right.
And you can see the way they look on their faces. They'll go, okay, I'm not at the end of the line here.
You know, it's so interesting that you mentioned this. I forgot all about this. I used to have to go to the emergency room when I worked at Cottage Hospital in the inpatient ward in order to, take people from the emergency room into the psych ward. And oftentimes they would have either a manic episode or a really severe depressive episode. And a psychiatrist would come in and meet them for the first time and say, you know, it's a pleasure to meet you. Don't worry about it. Everything's going to be fine. And I would watch the person go from hope, or at least sort of hope, to completely being deflated because they didn't believe that the person that was coming to help them understood what they were going through at all. So the idea that you're going to try to help people use their resources rather than, you know, give them false hope that everything's going to be fine, just leave it up to you, that's really, really important because I can't tell how many times I saw people look, you know, so devastated by somebody telling them everything was going to be okay. Because how did that person know anything about their life? And, you know, a lot of times people had a pretty horrible life. You know, you don't become suicidal for no reason, that's for sure. Some of it may be chemically, you know, induced by your brain chemistry, but a lot of it is, you know, the person has good reason to be suicidal, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I mean, reassurance and that kind of comment the doctor made is helpful in some circumstances. But this kind of circumstance, you got to be careful how you present what you're doing. Because that doctor and myself are thinking the same thing.
Right.
But we're presenting it a different way.
Well, you're presenting it with some compassion and the other person is presenting it with fear, in my opinion. They're afraid they're not going to be able to help the person. So they're trying to reassure them that they're going to be okay when really they don't even know that the person that they're telling, you know, these fairy tales to. I don't know. I remember watching at least a handful of people or more look like, you know, somebody popped their balloon when they were already having a really tough time.
So, yeah, I'm smiling because it's like I had a surgical procedure done in October. And an anesthesiologist comes up to talk to me. He starts asking me a few questions, and I go, you didn't read my chart, did you?
No.
I'm like, that was the wrong thing to say. She's going to put me under right now. Why did I piss her off? Yeah. But I can tell she didn't even know anything about me. Nothing.
Right, right.
And that made me feel like, I'm not sure she gets me.
Yeah.
And it's like, I'm going to go under for this procedure. It's like,
right.
I want someone there who's with me, who knows me.
Absolutely.
And I could have worded that differently. Okay.
Yeah. No, I get that. Okay. So really what we're both saying is compassion goes a long way. That's for sure. And understanding and taking your job seriously, right? By knowing who it is that you're treating. So again, anything else that is important? What you just mentioned was really, really important that, again, you can't tell people you're going to cure them, but you can certainly hopefully help them have some hope that you can that you can help them manage the situation in a way where they could have a productive life.
Yeah, I'll say, like, okay, we can try this. Here's why I think this might work in your case. And so I give a little background. I'm not saying we got four things to do. It's like, here's how I would rank them. And here's why in your case, I'm going with this because this works with this.
Okay. So you try to educate them as much as possible.
Educating makes it, you know, I could say I'm being lazy. That way I won't get called in the middle of the night. But like information has power to it.
Absolutely.
And it doesn't matter what your situation is. The more you know about it, the less threatening it is.
So we're speaking to a wide audience of people. A lot of them don't live in Santa Barbara. Where would you recommend people go if they're worried that they may have bipolar disorder or a relative or friend or to get some help?
Yeah, it's like, okay, so the way I see people from out of town.
Uh-huh.
I'll see, if you're looking for a referral for someone who's good, talk to your primary care doctor because they see people come in their office and they're going, oh my gosh, I don't know where to go with this.
Right.
So who do they refer to? Who do they know in town?
Right.
And if someone practices a faith, it's like, go talk to the priest, go talk to the rabbi, because you know darn well, those kind of people get all kinds of people come in their office and they're going, oh my gosh, this is not a faith thing. This is mental health.
Right.
So they're going to know people who they refer to also.
Well, you're bringing up a good point in the sort of faith department, because I've also met people when they're having a manic episode that have a spiritual kind of what they believe is an awakening in a very powerful way. I'm assuming you've seen that before.
Oh, yeah. Religiosity.
Yes. So is it just a function of properly medicating the person to help them sort of come down from that religiosity? Yeah.
It depends. If that person practices a certain faith, I would like to get a leader in that religious faith to come in. I'll talk to the person. Okay, here's what's going on. Here's what I'm seeing with the patient. Could you kind of help shepherd this person back to where they probably need to be?
Oh, okay.
And then, because I'm just a psychiatrist, but if there's a religious figure that they have a belief and a faith in, then I have two people helping my patient out, me and and the rabbi or priest or imam.
Okay. And are there national organizations that are devoted to the care of an education for people that have bipolar illness?
You know, like one thing I refer a lot of people to is NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness.
Oh, okay.
Do you know about NAMI?
I don't.
Okay, so it's a huge organization. And what they do is they provide education to family members of someone who has someone with a mental illness. They educate, they have resources, and they do lobbying. A lot of people with severe mental illness can't go to Sacramento, you know, the state capital in California, or Washington, D.C.
Right.
But family members can. And yep. Also, they provide support. And so NAMI is around. You can go to the website and figure out what area you go to. I mean, whatever family member is, and get hooked into the system there. Because, like, I had one of my colleagues from medical school, his sister was developing schizophrenia. And he goes, who do I go to? And like this town in Washington, I don't have a clue.
Right.
But I go, contact NAMI, okay? And the NAMI cannot give you a referral, but you talk to people in the NAMI group, who's their doctor?
Right.
Okay, right. Then you know, these people are grizzled veterans at this stuff, and they live in this town.
Right.
They'll help you go a long way towards where to go.
Okay.
So that's something else I forgot to drop off.
Yeah, very important information.
And they're very helpful. That organization, no matter where you contact them, anywhere in the country here, They'll pull you in, embrace you, and walk you through what they can do to help you with your sister or brother or whatever it is that's going on.
And if somebody is in a very acute manic or depressive episode, best thing to do is take the person to the emergency room?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. I just wanted to make sure that people know that if they have somebody that they're really scared about. And what if the person won't cooperate, especially if they're having a manic episode? What do you do in a situation like that?
It used to be you called 911 and the police would come out.
Uh-huh.
And then you're not quite sure where that's going to go. But there's been a lot more education and in-servicing on law enforcement about this kind of stuff.
Oh, okay.
And I feel more comfortable having them because they can actually bring the person to the hospital.
So if you're a danger to yourself or someone else, they can actually take you against your will?
Yes.
Is that how they sort of operate from that paradigm?
Yes.
Okay.
In some law enforcement agencies, they have mental health people that go out on those kind of calls.
Right, right.
And so they have a triage team that helps out with that stuff.
Well, we're just about out of time, Bob. Is there anything final sort of thoughts and ideas that you want to present? You've been incredibly informative. I really appreciate your willingness to come and share all of this. It's just, I mean, I've been a mental health person for, you know, 35 years, and I'm learning all kinds of new stuff here. So that's very cool.
Oh, I had a great time.
Good. Is there anything else that you want to say before we finish?
No, it's just that whatever condition you have, especially with bipolar disorder, don't give up. There's always something new coming in. I can go back. When lithium came out, there was a sense that, okay, we have bipolar disorder treated. We're done.
Right.
I go, no, we're not. I got all kinds of other things going on here. So then all these anti-seizure drugs came on. Also, other stuff has come on. So it's like there's always something new to take a look at to go at this.
So it's a very well-researched disease. Would you call it a disease?
It's a disease, a disorder.
Okay. Just curious.
Yeah.
Well, again, I thank you so much. This has been really, really helpful.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you. We hope you enjoyed this podcast. Remember, if you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation to the Fear Me Out podcast, please go to www.jccs.org and earmark your donation to this podcast. If you need more information about making a donation, you can contact Dr. Saperstein directly at 805-452-0006. Thank you.